Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this October 1st, the beginning of the new state and new federal fiscal year is coming in with a bang. Let's dig straight into the news. The news making headlines across the country and around the world. The partial government shutdown, the first federal shutdown in 17 years. Democrats and Republicans in D.C. unable to compromise on a continuing resolution to fund the federal government. But what does this mean for us here in Michigan? 41% of Michigan's budget comes from the federal government, although a shutdown doesn't mean all the money will stop flowing immediately, although it will slow. Several food and other assistance programs for the poor will be affected sooner than most. And the shutdown means federal employees in Michigan are being furloughed. That includes hundreds of Michigan National Guardsmen and women. Joining us now is the director of the Michigan budget, John Nixon. John, start please by just giving us a sense of where things stand right now.
Well, obviously, things have gone into a shutdown in Washington, D.C. They worked late into the evening. I quit watching about midnight where they didn't get the deal done. But basically, they've done a partial federal shutdown. And basically, what that means is those programs that are on the mandatory side of the budget will continue. Those programs that are in the discretionary portion will come to a shutdown. So many federal employees were furloughed this morning. And a lot of the different federal expenditures ceased as of today. Now, part of the issue is that what triggered it is the ending of the federal fiscal year, which was September 30th. So we're into a new federal fiscal year, and so they have no spending authorization in these programs, or there's no budget for them. But in many of the big programs, they're either pre-funded, or so means they're funded for about in advance of a quarter. So for a lot of the programs, they still have funding in them, so they'll be able to continue, or they have lapsing balances or balances that were unspent at the end of the year that they're carrying forward into the new fiscal year. So by and large, if this thing only lasts for a couple of days, we'll probably be able to weather the storm. You know, if this thing goes on for weeks and those lapsing balances terminate and expire, and then we get into the point where some of these bigger federal programs, you know, the pre-funding or the advance funding runs out, we're going to be in for a much bigger bigger problem as a state.
Can you walk us through from where you sit right now as far as what's going on? What is getting hit right now in Michigan? Because I know there are people waking up today saying, is Grandma going to get her Social Security check?
Yeah, Social Security is going to be fine. The big supportive services, Medicaid, is going to be fine. Food stamps have already been budgeted for the next month, for October. So the food stamp benefits will flow. The temporary assistance to needy families, that one's sunset last night at midnight. But we're trying to figure out, you know, as far as carry forward dollars, what we have to keep that program going. You know, there are some programs, some of the smaller programs, that we're actually trying to determine exactly what the ramifications are. But by and large, most of the programs that we administer will continue. But that's not to say that there'll be some that where the people aren't impacted. You know, we have a lot of federal employees within the state who are on furloughs right now, which we feel, you know, we feel badly about. That's unfortunate. And then we also have, you know, a lot of federally funded state employees that, you know, they're still on the job, but certainly we're trying to determine how this shutdown is going to impact them as well.
And there is, as you say, there are some discretionary programs that have been hit immediately. So I guess if some, am I correct, if someone was heading to, up to Sleeping Bear Park?
Yes, exactly. The national parks, I believe, are all shut down. A lot of the programs that you know, the school lunch program, that was impacted, the WIC program. But what the federal government's trying to do is they're trying to cobble together the lapsing balances and the funding. You know, this is one of those things, unfortunately, where I think a lot of people were hopeful they would get a resolution. And so now that we're in a shutdown, everybody's trying to figure out, okay, how can we keep the doors open? How can we keep things moving? You know, from the state level, we are in a position where in some of these programs, we've already got the payments set up to go. And we really can't stop them for the next few days. And so, you know, but if this persists, we're going to have to take action, because we obviously just don't have the resources to augment or supplant the federal spending in the state. You know, the federal government spends a lot of money in the state of Michigan. About 40% of our budget is federally funded, about $20 billion. So you know, it is a pretty significant amount. But the good news is that as a state, we've made some tough decisions, and we now are in structural balance. We've got money in our rainy day fund, and we're in a much better position to deal with this this kind of behavior at the federal government than we were just a couple of years ago. But the unfortunate thing is that it's just kind of status quo for the federal government now. I mean, they could really take a lead from the states who have done this, like the state of Michigan.
And what do you hear out of D.C.? That is it all reassuring or that alarms you?
Well, no, I don't think. I mean, I've got a call with the White House this afternoon with the budget staff in the White House, and the budget director should be on the phone with them, and we're going to get some updates on kind of where things are going. Obviously, there's gridlock back there, and it's unfortunate because really what people need to do is set aside their differences at this point. I mean, the only thing at stake right now is our country, you know. I mean, the stakes are pretty high, and so it's time to just come together and say, you know what, for the overall benefit of the hundreds of millions of people we have and we serve, we've got to get this done. And that's what many of the states have done. And so really, you know, as we're polarized on both sides now, it's really damaging to the overall, you know, benefit of the country. So, but what I'm hearing at this point is still just the bashing back and forth, you know, and it's not really a, hey, let's get together, let's compromise, let's get this thing done.
State Budget Director John Nixon, thanks for taking time to talk with us today on Stateside.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you.
The Affordable Care Act opened for business for consumers today, but thousands of low-income working people in Michigan are waiting to sign up for health insurance today because the wait isn't just because of the federal shutdown. It's because the state still hasn't filed a waiver with the federal government to run the Medicaid expansion. Jake Neer, reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. Jake, it sounds like we've got two different issues here, a technological one and then one having to do with these waivers. Start off by telling us what these waivers are and then how are they getting in the way of folks signing up for expanded Medicaid?
Well, first of all, the state decided not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act without putting in some of its own demands, I guess, that, you know, they didn't want to just accept the program as offered by the federal government. They wanted to put in some provisions that they said that Republicans here in the legislature say protect taxpayers. It makes sure that, you know, the state isn't on the hook for the expansion, paying for it, that is, if federal funding drops below a certain level. So all these things, they also wanted to add some incentives for healthy lifestyles, that sort of thing. And all those things have to be approved by the federal government. I think the one that they're waiting on right now just sort of outlines how the state plans to structure things like co-pays and premiums and things like that. That has to be approved by the federal government. So they have to submit a waiver. Once that's approved, then they can start, you know, signing people up for Medicaid, even though it doesn't take effect until March or April because the legislature decided not to give it immediate effect. If they would have done that, it would have taken effect on January 1st. But either way, they want to start signing up people as early as possible. And for states that got this done a little early, that decided to expand Medicaid the way that it was offered from the federal government, or they got their waivers in early and were approved early, they're going to be signing up people today. Whereas here in Michigan, we're still trying to get our ducks in a row, still trying to get the federal approval. And that means that people are going to have to wait for a little while before they can sign up.
Do we have any idea of when this is going to be fixed? What are you hearing from the Department of Community Health?
They're just saying right now that we want to try to sign people up as soon as possible. They're not giving any specific dates because they have not only have they not gotten the federal approval yet, they haven't even submitted the waiver yet for federal approval. So this is, you know, they've only had a short period of time since the governor signed this into law just a couple weeks ago. To get the waiver drafted and then and all that. So really, it's all up in the air right now. They don't know when this is going to happen. But what they're telling people right now is that they you know, because Michigan is going to be taking part in the federal exchange instead of having a state-run exchange, the Michigan Department of Community Health, they're telling people who would be part or think that they're going to be part of this expanded Medicaid population to go to the federal health website at healthcare.gov to see if they're eligible for the expanded population. They can do that today and then wait for more info when our program here in Michigan is up and running.
Now, let's talk about the technology. Speaking of the healthcare exchange and healthcare.gov, and here we have the technology letting us down. It sounds like some websites are down. What do you hear?
From what I'm hearing, there are people trying to sign up for health insurance on the federal exchange right now as we speak, and they're coming up with these error messages saying that they can't create an account, that things are just, you know, that there are glitches. Even if they do get through, you know, the first few steps, then an error message will come up later. From what I'm hearing, you know, it's because there's such a rush from people to all get, you know, because this is the first day that the exchange is up. There's just a heavy amount of traffic. And also because people who set these exchanges up, according to them, you know, it was a lot of technological infrastructure to set up in a short period of time. So they were almost sort of expecting this to happen. At least that's the word that we're getting from officials that are involved with this. You know, they just had so much to do in such a short period of time. It was almost inevitable that, you know, these glitches would show up.
Jake Neer with the Michigan Public Radio Network. Always good talking with you, Jake. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called kinship care. It means relatives stepping in to raise a relative's child, and it happens for many reasons, whether it's parents being incarcerated, being employed, physical or mental illness. All over Michigan, grandparents or other relatives are being called on to raise a child, and that presents challenges and it presents rewards. Lindy is with the Kinship Resource Center at Michigan State University's School of Social Work, and she joins us now from East Lansing. Lynn, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I noticed on your website that nationally there are about 4.9 million children in this country living in grandparent-headed households and another 1.9 million kids living in households headed by other relatives. Do you have any sense of how many families in Michigan are centered on kinship care?
Yes, I do. Right now in Michigan, this is based off of census data, we have probably about 150,000 children that are living with a grandparent. And of those 150,000, there's about 23,000 where the grandchildren are totally living with a grandparent and there's no parent present, no parent coming in and out of their lives at all.
And do you think this is increasing in Michigan?
It is increasing. If we look at the data that the census provides us, we see about probably an increase of about 7,000 children living with relatives or grandparents in the past since about 2009. So we do see an increase in that.
So as you work with families there with the Kinship Resource Center at Michigan State University, what are some of the reasons? Tell us some of the stories behind how this comes to be.
I have to be honest, the stories are so varied. It's pretty much anything and everything. Sometimes it's the death of the parents or, you know, in the case of a single parent, it could be the death of that parent and the other parent's not able to be located. We do get some about deployment where there's issues of trying to figure that out, how that's going to work best during the time that the parent is deployed. A lot of times we have stories of the parent is just not able to raise the child because of their own substance abuse issues, mental health issues, physical issues that make it impossible for them to raise the child, and so the grandparents or other relatives step in. And, of course, we also have abuse and neglect situations where, again, those grandparents and those relatives step in really before the child welfare system even gets involved.
I'm speaking with Lynn Nee, who's with the Kinship Resource Center at Michigan State University at the School of Social Work, talking about kinship care, which is relatives stepping in to raise a relative's child. And I'd like to look at the challenges, Lynn, and I suspect this is the kind of thing where someone goes in with the best of intentions, grandma or grandpa, and they're going to do the best job they can, but perhaps the job becomes too big for grandma. So I can imagine that there are a lot of unforeseen pitfalls and challenges.
Definitely, that's the case. Pretty much every phone call I have with a relative is that they're going to do whatever it takes to keep that child in the family. At a lot of cases, though, that's sort of at the detriment to their own economic, emotional, physical health. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges is there aren't a lot of resources available for these families if they're lower income. And the poverty rate actually for these families is much higher than the general poverty rate. We're looking at about 27, 28% poverty rate for these families. versus 15% to 16% for the general population. We're also looking at a higher number of these families dealing with children who have disabilities, whether that be a cognitive disability or a physical disability or an emotional disability. And so these families with all these great intentions come into this, and they're committed to doing whatever it is that they need to do. But at the same time, they can very quickly become overwhelmed by the needs of these children that they can't meet.
What is the ultimate goal for these families? Is there a single goal? Is it getting the kids back with the parent? Is it adoption that would make this all permanent?
I have to be honest. It varies family to family. I think a lot of families, a lot of grandparents and other relatives really hope that the biological parent will be able to take care of the child in the future. And one of the things we do tell them, it's like, you know, hope for 6 months, but plan for 6 years. You can't be sure that that's going to happen. Sometimes it's adoption, which can be a bit of a struggle because for those families who are not involved with the Department of Human Services, there's no funding to support that adoption. So sometimes it ends up just being really a long-term guardianship where basically that child is living with them to adulthood without that permanency that sometimes that's so important in the child welfare system. So we're kind of got these kids out there that are kind of just hanging out for, you know, 10, 11 years. They've got the security of the family, but they don't have the permanency.
Lynn, as you work with these families and you come to know the challenges and the rewards and people opening their homes and their hearts to children who need the help, what do you want to say to the leaders and the politicians in our state about kinship care and what these caregivers and children need most?
I think really there's a couple things that stand out for me. One, it's just having an awareness of these families. And I think that that's probably one of the big problems. These families don't tend to be strong advocates for themselves. They're just trying to get through the day. So be really cognizant of who are these families in the communities. And also to understand that a lot of these families aren't getting any support. There's no, you know, unlike foster care where the kids are, where there's foster care payments and there's training, that's not available so much for these kinship families. And so we really need to say what needs to happen to help these families be able to stay together, because these families really are helping keep children out of the child welfare system. They just oftentimes need a little extra support. And I think probably the third thing then is that we have a limited number of support groups around the state, and part of that has to do with the funding that's available for those agencies that are working with families. So really looking at how can we provide this very minimal level of support to enable families to join together and come together and support each other in a healthy environment that, you know, facilitates the family's success.
The Kinship Care Resource Center at Michigan State University can provide kinship families with support, case advocacy services, training, and workshops. And we have put a link to their website on our website at michiganradio.org. So just click on the stateside link. Lindy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate it.
Corruption, political shenanigans, murder. Now, that may sound to you like life in a big city in 2013, but my next guest says, no, think again. His latest novel is set in the Detroit of 1912, and from his research, there was plenty of crime and corruption happening in those supposedly good old days. Kalamazoo-based writer D.E. Johnson is out with the fourth novel in his 1910s Detroit series. This latest historical mystery is called Detroit Shuffle. D.E. Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
So this is the fourth of your mystery thrillers set in early 20th century Detroit. So what drew you to that period and setting in the first place?
I really love the time period. The early 20th century, I think, is the most fascinating time in U.S. history. Everything was in turmoil. People were afraid there was going to be a revolution. There were anarchists and socialists all over the place, millions of immigrants coming into the country. Everything was sort of up for grabs at that time. And most people had absolutely nothing. And the few who had money had it all. And so there was this incredible inequality socially, but a lot of really interesting things going on. So the time period really drew me first. And Detroit has always fascinated me. In my lifetime, it's been in decline. And I didn't really understand what an amazing city it had been. And so going back and doing the research and, you know, learning that it was known as the Paris of the West, you know, that sort of thing, mm-hmm. that it really, really was an amazing town.
And picking that era, if you're talking about that first decade of the 20th century, it's researchable, isn't it? You can
yeah.
go and dig in. Where do you do your research? Because your detail is quite incredible.
Yeah, I do a lot of it at the library. So go to the Detroit Public Library and dig through the old newspaper archives. That's been the best source. But I have a lot of old car industry detail throughout the series, and a lot of that I get from the Benson Ford Research Center at the Henry Ford Museum. And there's just, you know, you can find on Google eBooks the 1912 ordinances of the city of Detroit, you know, just weird titles like that that for some reason they put up, but very helpful for me.
I'm speaking with author D.E. Johnson, whose fourth book in his 1910s Detroit series is called Detroit Shuffle. Tell us about your hero, Will Anderson.
He's a bit of a mess.
That's true.
In the first book, he starts out as a drunk. He has incredible guilt and hasn't gotten himself to the point that he can try to make up for what he did. And in the first book, it becomes clear what he did and what happened and why. And he works on kind of picking up the pieces of his life as he goes through the following books. But what he had done in the beginning is what started the dominoes falling that have led him to a whole bunch of trouble.
And here he is with the other leading character. Tell us about Elizabeth.
Elizabeth is pretty cool.
She's pretty feisty.
She's feisty. She's a modern woman, a suffragist, handy with a gun when she has to be, very, very advanced for the time period. She drives, which is unusual, and very, very forward thinking.
Was she based on anyone you encountered in your research? I mean, this book focuses on the women's suffrage movement, so there's a lot of real folks. And I just wondered, did someone inspire you?
Clara Arthur is one. She was one of the founders of the Michigan Equal Suffrage Association, and a real, real tough woman. And you know, going back into the mid-1800s, she was working on suffrage, and she was one of the real leaders during this 1912 election.
Well, give us an excerpt, if you will, so we can get a sense of what is in Detroit Shuffle. And for those who aren't familiar with your series, the 1910s Detroit series, a sense of D.E. Johnson's writing.
Sure. This is a ways into the book. Will is trying to get a couple of young men to help him on a little caper. And it's a couple of guys, Francis, who has been diagnosed as schizophrenic with autistic tendencies, and Robert, who's Elizabeth's brother, who Will helped break out of Eloise Hospital, the big asylum in Detroit Breakdown, and now he's taken them out to dinner. And this is Will talking. "Wouldn't you like to have a secret adventure with just Robert and me? No one else would know." Francis looked at Robert before saying, "Yes, I would like a secret adventure." "Robert," I asked, "what about you?" He nodded and, looking down at the table, smiled. "I like secrets." "All right," I whispered. "I just have to get my hands on a key and we'll start it, maybe later this week." "A key?" Robert asked. "To what?" "Robert can pick locks," Francis said in a normal tone. "He could get out of the buildings at Eloise and break into any room in the hospital." Several people turned toward us. I smiled at them and waved them back to their suppers, trying to convey a sense that I was humoring these lunatics. However, my smile was real. This could be perfect. "Maybe," I started, "maybe we could do this tonight." "Ah, an owl job," Francis said. I gave him a sidelong glance. Well, he was a reader. Yes, we'll have to do this at night." Francis's mouth tugged to the side in annoyance. "We have to do what?" I leaned in close to them. "Steal some surveillance equipment and install it at the Dime Building." Glancing at Robert, I asked, "Do you think you can pick the door locks at the Dime Building?" He pursed his lips and nodded with a casual confidence, then leaned down low over the table, his shirt pressed into the remains of his pie. "Are we spying on somebody?" he asked in a hoarse whisper. "Yes," I whispered back, "the director of the Michigan Liquor Association." "That sounds boring," he whispered. I cut my eyes from him to Francis. It won't be. He's a criminal. They both nodded. This will be dangerous, I whispered, because there will be guards in the buildings, and they will have guns. I don't like guards, Robert said, or guns. I am not afraid. Francis's right cheek contorted with a tick. It will mean going back to Eloise Hospital, I whispered, sneaking in. Robert's eyes widened and began to fill with tears. No! People spun in their seats, staring at us. I'm not going back to the hole. I'm not going. Shh, Robert, shh. I put my hand on his shoulder. It's all right. I won't force you to do anything. I'll get a key to Eloise somewhere. Robert quieted to a sad little whimper. The other customers turned back to their slop. Why do we need to go back to Eloise Hospital? Francis asked. For the equipment. Your father had dictation recording equipment that... The dictograph and telegraphone, Francis said. Well, yes, I was surprised he knew. Francis thought for a moment. Shiver me timbers, he said, with absolutely no inflection. I decided pirate lingo needed some enthusiasm behind it to be effective. Is that all we need to do at Eloise Hospital? I nodded. You must go, Robert Hume, Francis said. We must help John Doe. It is the pirate code. The pirate code? Robert sounded unsure. We are a crew. We do or die. I don't want to die, Robert said in a tiny voice. Then you just have to do, Francis replied. Oh, Robert said. Okay.
Very good. That was from Detroit Shuffle, writer D.E. Johnson's fourth book in his 1910s Detroit series. Now, what's ahead for you? Do you have installment five ahead, or do you want to work your way through the 20th century?
The next book is going to be set in Chicago. So I really wanted to – I've done four books in 4 years with these characters set in Detroit, and I really needed to evict these characters from my head for a while. And I didn't give them back their security deposits either. And so I'm working on a book set in Chicago at the turn of the century and set in the gambling world, which was really amazing. And it's revolving around the life of a guy named Big Jim O'Leary, who was known as the gambler boss of the yards down at the stockyards on the south side. And he was the son of Catherine O'Leary, the woman who allegedly burned down Chicago.
Mrs. O'Leary's cow.
Yeah. So he had this chip on his shoulder his whole life and was a big, blustery, larger-than-life kind of character. And I've just found him to be really intriguing. And so I'm writing a coming-of-age story about a young man who wants to be like O'Leary. And so he goes to work for him and runs through lots of interesting adventures while I tell O'Leary's story.
It sounds very, very rich. Kalamazoo-based writer D.E. Johnson is out with the fourth novel in his 1910s Detroit series. The latest historical mystery is called Detroit Shuffle. Thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A record number of Michigan schools are struggling to stay in the black. So far, the headlines have focused on the fiscal problems of some of Michigan's more populated counties. A new state law allows state officials to dissolve and consolidate small schools with big problems. But as Interlochen Public Radio's Linda Steffen reports, there are schools in northern Michigan that are paying very close attention to the new law as well.
In Sutton's Bay, the last Saturday of summer vacation was dedicated to a massive school fundraiser.
We're here out supporting Flotilla. Flotilla will go to supporting a lot of stuff in our school.
A lot of people have already heard this story. It looks like the Leelanau County tourist town has probably broken a world record for stringing together more than 2,000 canoes and kayaks in a massive flotilla on Sutton's Bay.
Ohio! Welcome.
But this event is part of a bigger story, as Mike Hill can help explain. He's the superintendent of the Traverse Bay Area Intermediate School District. It serves Sutton's Bay and other districts in the five-county region that surrounds Traverse City. Hill says he's impressed with Sutton's Bay's fundraising, its creative budgeting, and he's impressed at the simple fact that somehow the school district remains solvent.
They have tried so many different innovative approaches and initiatives to maintain the identity of that school district, the pride of that school district, the student achievement levels of that school district, extracurricular. It really is a fascinating story, one that I think brings a lot of pride for this region.
a success story? Yes. But is the district at risk of going into the red and one day, maybe, being dissolved?
Yes.
So says Mike Hill with the Five County ISD and Mike Murray, superintendent of Sutton's Bay Public Schools.
Funding schools the way we do, so much money per pupil, makes those districts that have declining population, puts them in a spot where they can't adjust quickly enough.
Murray gives an example. Say a district lost 25 students.
That would be a considerable amount of money, $150,000. But losing 25 students might mean that on a bus, you would go from busing 55 students to 52 or 53 students each bus run. You can't reduce the number of bus runs. You still have to cover the same amount of territory, and you still have the same bus costs. Each classroom might go from 27 students down to 25 students. That doesn't mean you can reduce the number of teachers.
It's not necessarily the case that schools with big money problems are failing academically, nor are they always financially mismanaged. There are other small rural districts with declining enrollment and dwindling budgets where student achievement remains high. After many years of recession, this is actually a pretty old story. One Senator Howard Walker of Traverse City hopes will soon be behind us. He championed a small equity payment this year. That means more money for the state's lowest-funded schools, including a lot of northern districts. He spoke with me by phone recently from the floor of the state Senate.
I'm real confident that northern Michigan schools are going to stay solvent. I think that we've turned the corner. I think that funding increases have happened and will continue to happen. I'm optimistic that way.
But more schools than ever face big financial hurdles. One solution has been a push for consolidation. Consolidation of services, even consolidation of districts. And in the case of small schools that end up with big money problems, under a law passed this summer, the state can now force dissolution and consolidation. It's already happened with two districts in the southern half of the state. Both Walker and Superintendent Murray say it may make some sense to rethink school district boundaries. Murray even says consolidation, which some would call the C word, is growing a bit more palatable.
The financial crisis we're in, I think, has made people more willing to take a look at options, because in the end, it's not the school mascot that's important. It's what kind of quality education is each child going to get.
Murray says it's true that larger districts can have an easier time absorbing budget ups and downs, and size can also mean greater efficiency. But he also worries one-size-fits-all approaches that have been floated around in Lansing could do more harm than good up north, where consolidation doesn't always make as much sense as it does in some of the state's more populated regions.
The idea of consolidation shouldn't happen just for the sake of consolidation. It should happen because it's more cost-effective.
Murray says Leelanau County schools have considered consolidation. Financially, it wouldn't benefit. Meanwhile, Sutton's Bay and nearby districts are working together more and more, often consolidating services through the intermediate school district. At the ISD, Mike Hill prefers the term collaboration for these projects, and he says it's a good thing, but he doubts either service collaboration or district consolidation would go far enough to solve the financial struggles of local school districts in the region he serves.
You know, if we've got districts that are financially stressed, and we do have the majority of our districts are managing their resources in a fiscally responsible way, something has to change. So what that is, I don't know.
Hill says it's time to at least ask another big question, whether the state's per-pupil funding system is working. But for now, the emphasis from leadership in Lansing seems to be on cost savings through efficiency.
All right, let's go get our canoe.
Back at the flotilla last month, Sutton's Bay freshman Will Fott told me he's well aware his school is struggling.
Oh, yeah, I hear it all the time. I mean, the system can be a little weird in terms of funding sometimes. But I like our size now, actually.
Will says in Sutton's Bay, you'd rarely get cut from a sports team. Others mention easy access to teachers and the chance to do a lot of activities with less competition. Everything from band to drama and student government. And if the economy doesn't turn around soon, proponents of Michigan's smaller districts may find themselves increasingly making the case for their existence. For Stateside, I'm Linda Steffen.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it was a gift with a capital G. Real estate developer and Miami Dolphins owner Stephen Ross made major headlines last month with an eye-popping $200 million gift to the University of Michigan. His donation is earmarked for the U of M Athletic Department and to the business school that already bears his name from an earlier gift of $113 million. What goes into these huge gifts? What do the donors expect for their generosity? How deeply do major donors like Stephen Ross influence higher education in America? Well, joining us for this conversation is Dr. John Burkhart. He directs the National Center for Institutional Diversity at the University of Michigan, and he's the special assistant to the provost for university engagement, and he's kind enough to join us now in the studio. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. This is great. What a wonderful conversation to have.
Yep, and it sounds like something that has been going on. Certainly there has been highly successful fundraising happening, not just at the University of Michigan, but big institutions, big donors. And so not just to focus the spotlight on U of M, when any university gets a large donation, just how beholden does it make the university to the donor?
Well, this is a question that we've been talking about for hundreds of years in American higher education. And the answer is, there's an influence there, and the influence is something that people sometimes are quite concerned about. But in the case of this particular gift, it actually has sparked something that I think is quite interesting, quite important. A tension gets created between the values that are expressed and held by many of us on the campus, and it's a dynamic tension. And so Ross's gift, that generosity, has many people thinking, what do we do now to make sure that the balance of values at a place like the University of Michigan is faithfully represented?
And how do you see this particular gift when he looks at athletics, he looks at the business school that clearly he already thinks much of, the donation and the beautiful building that's there that bears his name? How does that gift sync up with the values of the
university? Well, he's an investor. This is where his resources originate. And Stephen Ross has put something on the table. As great investors do, they make a statement with the financial moves that surround them. We're all celebrating across the campus, but the key point is we're celebrating it in different ways.
How so?
Well, I think that we need to pay attention to what went along with the announcement of the Ross gift. He not only made a magnificent gift on behalf of the university in two large areas, he also committed to being the leader of the upcoming campaign that will be announced early in November. And in that role, he will be involved in countless conversations across the country with people who may see the university in different ways than he does. He's obviously lifted the bar, but he's also said, I want to be in those discussions that, in effect, are going to provide contested ideas about what Michigan should be in the future.
To those who say he's not an educator, why should someone who is, you know, a successful business person be in the conversations of what higher ed should be? Not just Stephen Ross, but big donors across the country and the foundations, the philanthropist.
Well,
do they have a place at the table?
They certainly do. I'm an educator, and I frankly would feel bereft if I wasn't being influenced by the world around me. What matters is not defined entirely between East University and State Street. Mm-hmm. I think that a question of the sort that you're asking is what's the appropriate role for the private sector to influence the values that are mediated on the university campus? We might even ask, what role should the public sector, what role should legislators play in determining the direction of the University of Michigan? And does that role become less emphatic with the decline of public resources?
Correct.
So we're in a very dynamic situation. And I'm pleased that someone like Stephen Ross is willing to put his money on the table to launch this conversation. But it's the conversation that matters.
I'm speaking with Dr. John Burkhardt, who directs the National Center for Institutional Diversity at the University of Michigan, as we look at big donors, big gifts made to institutions across the country, certainly not just to the University of Michigan. And it makes me wonder, as you put these together and you see these donations coming, what kinds of conversations happen, perhaps probably behind closed doors, in a sense of a donor whose values may not reflect that of the university's?
Well, this is always a challenge. Yeah. The university has a very wide set of values, and while it's the responsibility of the president and members of the board to represent them, I think that President Coleman is quite aware, because of her engagement throughout higher education, that the values don't line up in some perfect, clear, explicit statement.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to find individuals who want to move the institution in different ways. There was a point in time when people felt that we needed to have women's colleges. And it was a controversial idea then when we started to admit women to the medical school here. It was described as a great experiment. Now we look back and say, my gosh, of course that was the right thing to do. But
so there might be a point of no return. There's a breaking point, if you will, where an institution may say, you know what, thanks, but no thanks.
Well, absolutely. And I guess it is obvious to say those gifts are never announced. So my guess is that there are not only cases where the institution, in its wisdom, has to close off a conversation that might otherwise result in a gift. There's probably even more instances where the discourse between the potential donor and the university leadership results in a solution that does accommodate the intent of the donor within the broad framework of values that we hold.
I have to wonder, John, are these big donations creating a two-tier system with, you have like the big names like Michigan who attract a Helen Zeller or Stephen Ross? Can the smaller, lesser known schools attract big bucks donations, or are they, you know, are they losing out to powerful elite institutions
that affect powerful
elite donors?
A real problem if you take higher education as a broad system rather than institution by institution.
Yes.
Clearly, the ability to attract the kind of attention that the Ross gift has is something that is available to places like the University of Michigan. We just completed a study where we looked at Hispanic-serving institutions throughout the country, and these are the places where many of our future Latino students are going to go. They, frankly, don't have the capacity to raise the kind of money that would allow them to lower student debt at the end of college years, or build the facilities, or
have the resources.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there clearly is a challenge in this regard. I don't know if the challenge is rooted in the dynamics of higher education as much as it might be part of a society where frequently power accumulates and wealth begets wealth. And so the University of Michigan benefits from that because of our history and the success of our alums. But all of us who care about education in society worry about issues of affordability and access for individuals who aren't coming to Ann Arbor.
And from all of this, for those who worry that we're outsourcing parts of our nation's higher education policy to the big donors and to the private philanthropic sector, what do you say to that?
Well, I think that's something that we really need to be paying attention to in this generation. In part because it reflects a diminished public investment in our colleges and universities. And,
meaning somebody has to take up the slack.
Well, yes, and philanthropy is unlikely, oh, probably unable, to substitute from adequate public support. And if the result is that fewer people are able to benefit from attending college and universities, or we do evolve into the system of haves and have-nots, I mean educationally, where we end up with a separate but unequal system of higher education across the country, that does not bode well for our democratic practice. That does not bode well for what I think we seek in the kind of nation we've described for ourselves.
Dr. John Burkhart directs the National Center for Institutional Diversity at the University of Michigan and also the Special Assistant to the Provost for University Engagement. And he was kind enough to join us here in the studio.